and I'm happy to be here. So I'm going to talk about some work that I'm writing up with my student, Yongchao Lu, on some new n equals 2 supersymmetric conformal field theories in four dimensions, which are rank 1, which I'll tell you, remind you what that is. This is a bit of an overstatement. I'll just give some evidence for the existence of these conformal field theories. And basically, I'll construct the Coulomb branch, consistent Coulomb branch, which I'll call CB geometries, right, like the Seibert-Witten geometries, if you like, for these things. And rank 1 means that the complex dimension of the Coulomb branch is 1. So the simplest possible case, just because rank 2 is too hard. OK, so that's what I'm going to do. The problem, actually, I'll lay it out for you in just a few minutes. It will seem very simple, but unexpectedly, turns out that it's not so simple. And we'll even, despite this problem being around for, I guess, 20 years now, we have found yet another one, or maybe more than one. So the outline of the talk is that first I'll talk about the classification, and I think we have a complete classification, of Coulomb branches which are homeomorphic to the complex plane. And then I will tell you what I know about some more exotic possibilities, in which you have one complex dimensional Coulomb branches, but they're not homeomorphic to a complex plane. And I was going to then talk about how you use the data that I get to compute various things like central charges. But after writing up this stuff, I think there's no way I'm going to get to this unless everybody forgoes cookies. So, so let me start with planar Coulomb branches. So, well, if we're looking for a scale invariant theory, the possible geometries are very, very simple. The only thing that's allowed is that the geometry of the Coulomb branch be that of a cone, right? Something like this. So this would be the conformal point, and every place else, the scale symmetry is spontaneously broken. And we'll call the a good complex coordinate U. So that will be my name for my Coulomb branch coordinate. So what are the sorts of things that we could ask about this? So this will be the point U equals 0. So there's the kind of the opening angle of this cone. There's the scaling dimension of the U coordinate. So here are some things that you would want to know. Theta has some deficit angle.
I'm sorry, you're just putting a math which is from the kinetic term of,
right,
of the U1.
Yeah, exactly. So these are things we'd like to know about what is allowed. There's the mass dimension of U, which I'll call D of U. There's more than just, this is a special geometry, so there's more than just a metric. There's also the U1 coupling, which can be thought of as the complex effective coupling as a function of U, which transforms as a section of an SL2Z bundle. So that is to say, there's an extra piece of information in this geometry. What is the electric magnetic duality, or SL2Z monodromy, as you go around that the conformal point? So I'll call that K0. So it's just an element of SL2Z, or rather a conjugacy class. And but there's lots of other things you would want to ask. These things are more or less directly related to this geometry, but there are other things we'd want to ask about the conformal field theory. Among them, the conformal field theory may have a flavor symmetry called F. It could have some central charges, and the ones where we're most interested, or the ones we have the best handle on, are the central charge and the current algebra for the flavor symmetry, the A and C central charges. And then, of course, there's not only a Coulomb branch, there's Higgs branches, kind of two generic Higgs branches that can appear here of dimensions H0 and H1. So we would like, it'd be nice to see what we could say about these things.
Sorry, what is H0?
This would be the dimension of the Higgs branch, which sticks out of the conformal point. And this is the one of the Higgs branch which sticks out onto the generic point on the Coulomb branch, the mixed branch in this case. They could be zero, of course, but they do occur in general. So I will, in constructing the geometries, be able to read off for you the flavor symmetries and tell you some things about the flavor symmetries. And there's a lot more that can be said about the central charges and the dimensions of the Higgs branches and relate and constraints on these guys, but I won't get to them in this talk.
When you say Higgs branch, you mean a conventional Higgs branch that parameterized by hypermultiplet of the theory or
right.
by monopoles and there's no.
Well, they are given by VEVs of neutral in the low energy theory.
Yeah.
They're given by VEVs of neutral hypermultiplets.
Okay.
Right. So that's all I mean by a Higgs branch. And they can either have sort of, in this picture, kind of support at just a point. There's only one point that's picked out, so it would have to be this point. That's what I would call the usual Higgs branch. But there could be a mixed branch, which even though they're neutral hypermultiplets, there's also a massless vector multiplet at every point along. Thus would be these mixed branches. Anyway, like I said, I'm not going to actually talk about them any further. So these three pieces of data are very rigidly related, and in a somewhat different context, Kodaira classified all the possible scale invariant geometries of this nature. And so I'm going to make a little table here which I'll be extending. So he gave them some names. And so let me just make a table here. So a name, I'll tell you what the deficit angle is, the scaling dimension is, and what the associated monodromy is. And the names are just some arbitrary names. Maybe I'll tell you where they came from. These aren't Kodaira's names, actually. He called these like 2-star, 3-star, 4-star, 1-0-star, things like this. Anyway, some arbitrary names. And what you find is that there are 7 possible scale invariant cones with a consistent monodromy, and the deficit angles are 5/6, 3/4, 2/3, 1/2, 1/3, 1/4, and 1/6.
And the space, what is the number of spatial time dimension?
It's just one. This is just or one complex. Two.
In SCFT.
Oh no, I'm in 4 space time dimensions.
No more. I see.
Yeah. So this is like a you know, a Z6, Z4, Z3, Z2 orbifold, and these things have kind of larger opening angles. And the associated dimensions are this. It's easy to write just from writing down a flat metric on these guys, that the that these have to be the scaling dimensions if these are the opening angles. And these are the only kind of allowed opening angles, because then you need an element of SL2Z, which has, or whose sixth power comes back to the unity, or the fourth power, and so forth. And so it's, well, here are the elements. In this list. Oh, I should have said, so S and T are just some generating matrices of SL2Z. And what all that matters is the conjugacy class of these guys. And this is of these seven guys correspond to the seven sort of non-trivial parabolic conjugacy classes.
Say Zagreb Witten Coulomb branch would be D4 in this or it's not.
No, well, it doesn't exist in this.
Doesn't exist. But
these are scale invariant guys. So
I
could scale into, say, a monopole or a dion singularity by itself. What does that look like? Uh-huh. That's not in this list of scale invariant singularities. That would be one of the so-called AN, I'll call it AN minus one singularities. So that the deficit angle, it has zero opening angle. That is to say, it's a cusp. And the scaling dimension in this case of the parameter is one, and the conjugacy class would be t to the minus n. N can be any positive integer. Okay. This has the interpretation of the singularity that comes from a low energy electromagnetic theory with a charge square root of n hypermultiplet. Or n charge 1 hypermultiplets, if you wanted to do it that way. There's another set, the so-called dn guys as well, of singularities. These guys are not scale invariant, right? They are infrared-free theories, and so they have a lambda pole of strong coupling scale, unlike these theories. So I'm going to concentrate on these theories, though, of course, the an singularities are going to play an important role in what I'm about to say. OK. So the okay, good. So that's
so for example, the D4 you can realize in SU2 with four flavor.
Yes.
And
so for example, but there's more than one. In the original papers, there were two different field theories with a D4 singularity. So that's what I'm knowing this. The scale invariant cone isn't enough to specify the field theory. So what we need, there's more data to a conformal field theory than this. So
mathematically speaking, this is the classification of what?
Of elliptic fibers over the complex plane. The complex plane given the U parameters, and you put the condition that it's a smooth elliptic vibration, so the fibers don't become so singular that as a two complex dimensional surface, that it develops any singularities. And this is the classification. But anyway, so that was a different motivation, but it ends up classifying these scale invariant rigid special Kähler geometries. Okay, so we need more than just this information, and at least one other piece of data is, so I guess we need more data.
Of course, a priori there's no guarantee that given one of these geometries will be a field theory.
Right, that's what I said at the very beginning. I'm only parameterizing some Coulomb branches. It's not a proof, it's evidence maybe, but it's not a proof that the conformal field theorems exist. So, one thing is the spectrum of relevant operators in n equals 2 operators, n equals 2 preserving operators. Let's say that they have some coupling, some positive mass dimension couplings, which I'll call MI. I'm thinking of these as mass operators, though they don't actually all have to have that interpretation. So what happens to, you know, our geometry if I turn on some relevant operators? So this geometry is going to get deformed at values of the VEVs large compared to the MIs, right? I don't expect any deformation, so it's still going to look like this cone here, but something funny is going to happen at short distances, and this nice conical singularity will be deformed into some more complicated, maybe collection of singularities. Okay? And this is actually what I want to describe. I'm going to classify, therefore, so this is really my mission, classify all complex deformations of the Kodaira singularities, which preserve the n equals 2 conditions, which mathematically is a rigid special Kähler structure.
But scale invariance would be lost? Or?
Yeah, I'm breaking it explicitly by turning these guys on. But I claim I can't really, this isn't enough information just from the geometry to specify a conformal field theory. And it turns out that there's, I'll try to convince you, that there's just a discrete set of possible distinct ways of turning these deformations on, and I'll propose those as a classification of the possible conformal field theories. Okay. So related to this is, maybe I'll redraw this picture looking from the top. So it's just, this is my U plane, and here's my singularity. And I said if I went around some path here, I had some monodromy, which I call K0. So this is going to break up into a bunch of singularities. And then I can, you know, they'll each have their own monodromies. So I will, I'll label these 1 through z. So z will be the number of singularities that this one breaks, that the conformal point breaks up into under a mass deformation. And I'll label their SL2z monodromies, you know, by picking a basis of cycles and a base point and all that, and an ordering of these guys and so forth. Okay. Finding the possible mass deformation certainly will involve finding this pattern of splitting of monodromies in this sense. Okay, that's not obvious that will tell us everything, but it turns out that this basically solving this sort of algebraic problem will turn out to basically solve the problem.
Excuse me. Suppose you start from from UV Lagrangian, if there exists one, for example, SU2 with 4 mm-hmm. flavor, these masses are the mass to each flavor, for example. Is that correct?
Yeah. If I turn on generic masses, so let's take SU2 with 4 flavors. They're 4 independent mass parameters, and I turn them on. It turns out that my single singularity breaks up into 6 singularities. They move around as I change those 4 mass parameters.
And if you start, E678, this is Minahan-Lemachevsky, for example, mm-hmm. and you turn on mass of the operator on the Higgs branch, or?
The Higgs branch? No. there's a mass deformation in those curves, which is just this mass deformation here. In the E8 case, because it has an E8 flavor symmetry, there are 8 mass parameters.
Okay.
It turns out that the singularity, as I turn on those 8 parameters, breaks into 10 singularities, which move around in some way.
Okay.
This is what I'm trying to describe, classify all these possible behaviors.
Thank you.
So related to that, one thing I should say is if there is a flavor symmetry under which these guys transform as mass parameters, I guess that's what I would mean by mass parameters in this case. That is to say, these guys are like the transforms as transform, the MIs transform in the adjoint representation of the flavor group, right? Then the geometry that I find here as a residue of, even though the turning on the MIs explicitly breaks the flavor symmetry, there's left over unbroken the discrete vial subgroup of the flavor group. And that means that in the this geometry can only depend on so the Coulomb branch geometry can depend on some set of polynomials of the original mass parameters, which form a set of invariants of the vial, are invariant under the vial group of the flavor symmetry. Now, it turns out that if you have the specific basis of these polynomials isn't unique. However, the set of their scaling dimensions, you can always choose a basis which are homogeneous polynomials in the MIs, and the set of these scaling dimensions actually completely specifies the vial group, or the flavor symmetry group. And so if I can figure out what set of these MAs enter into the geometry, I can read off at least the vial group of the flavor group, which is almost the same as reading off the flavor group, except that there's the BN and CN series have the same vial group, so there's a little ambiguity there. I'll talk about that.
For E8, you don't have just 8 parameters, but you have 248 parameters.
No, 8 parameters.
But this is not the adjoint representation.
Okay, so I can use flavor rotations to diagonalize them. So I can always put these guys, they really parameterize a Cartan subalgebra of E8. So there's only 8 independent parameters.
Individual singularity, when the bigger singularity splits up, does that look like one of those A's and B's?
Okay, great question. That's the next, I'll get there in a second. And that's the key physical point, if you like. So, actually, before I get there, just to make things a little bit more concrete, so algebraically, how do we go about doing this? Well, we can think of it in the same way Kodaira did, but or more to the point as Seiberg and Witten did, is that we parameterize this electromagnetic, low-energy electromagnetic coupling as the complex structure of an elliptic curve of a 2 torus that varies over each point on the Coulomb branch. So I can specify this geometry just by giving a family of elliptic curves that vary as a function of holomorphically as a function of U. And elliptic curves I can always write. So this is the Seiberg-Witten curve. I can always write in Weierstrass form, right? Like this. And so, and with some basic assumptions about how things behave at large values of U's and the masses that come from physical scaling assumptions, that and holomorphy, F and G are just polynomials in the U's and these mass invariants. And so we just need to find these two polynomials, f and g, and we specified the curve. So algebraically, that's what we're trying to do. That's not quite enough. You need also a one form, which is a meromorphic one form on this curve for each value of u. It satisfies some differential equation. It's proportional to the, or equal to, a constant multiple of the holomorphic one form on the curve up to some total derivative on the Riemann surface. Anyway, there's some differential equation like this, which is, since it's only in one variable, there's no obstruction to integrating it, so this is always easy to solve. But it also satisfies a much more difficult condition, that the set of residues of the poles of lambda have to be in the weight space of the, so they have to be in the integral linear combinations of the original mass parameters. Okay? And this is the condition which is very hard to satisfy and provides all the constraints and where all the hard work has to go. And I'm not going to say too much about it, except to tell you that the point came where we had to do some hard work. So let's say I have this curve. How do I figure out what this picture here of the geometry looks like? Well, I can more or less just read it off from this curve. Wherever two branch points on the right-hand side, two zeros on the right-hand side converge, that's where a singularity is occurring. If you like, that's where one of the cycles of this torus is pinching down. And so the singularities in the u-plane are at the zeros of the discriminant of this thing, which is just, you know, g squared plus f cubed, 27 g squared plus 4 f cubed, or something like that. So if I know these things, I compute the discriminant, it's some polynomial in the u's, it's zeros, tell me the position of those guys. And then also just, you know, as I do little cycles in u, I can ask how a canonical basis of cycles on this torus comes back to itself, and I can read off these SL2Z monodromies as well. So this records all that monodromy data, and there's some one-form data that I'm sweeping under the rug for the moment. Okay. So since it will be useful to us, let's figure out the order of this discriminant polynomial for each of these guys here, or rather, I'll just tell you what the answers are. It's the discriminant for the E8 singularity is an order 10 polynomial. So the maximal possible deformation would break it up. It can have at most 10 distinct zeros, so that it could break up into at most 10 singular points, and so forth for other ones along the list.
But when you have this kind of singularity, can you review that you can put these additional angles and it would be like a repetition of this, or there is no any kind of, you know, this periodicity in the picture of u?
Well, here I'm picking u as a as a single-valued, I mean, has periodicity, regular periodicity here. I mean, on a cone, I mean, on the complex plane with the origin removed, I can just give it a single global complex coordinate, which I'm calling u. So u doesn't have any, here you see. And maybe I should say here, the order of this, the zero of the AN singularity is N. okay. So the strategy then is basically to find these polynomials f and g and such that the number of zeros without multiplicity of the discriminant is some given number. If I just wanted to break up into under some generic, the number of zeros at generic values of these mass parameters is z. So like I said, if it's an order, we know for the E8 case it's an order 10 polynomial, so you might expect that the most general complex deformation you could turn on would break it up into 10 separate zeros, and indeed that's the case. But there may be some other pattern with fewer numbers of m such that when you turn on generic values of those m's, you break up, this thing breaks into a smaller number of zeros. Okay? So this is some algebraic problem to find this. It's actually not an easy problem. It involves solving simultaneous systems of polynomial equations, and they quickly, as you go up in that list, gets out of hand. But I'll try to tell you some tricks we have for simplifying the problem. And then, once you've found such a polynomial, you can just read off, you know, the spectrum of dimensions of these mass invariants will tell us at least the Weyl group of the flavor symmetry. So then we could immediately read off the flavor symmetry. But of course, to check that this is really a rigid special Kähler geometry, I also have to find the specific way in which these polynomials depend on the mass parameters such that and show and find a Seiberg-Witten 1 form that has this property. Okay? If you can do that, then you know it's a rigid special Kähler geometry. And this is the really ugly step in this procedure. So so now getting back to your question, the problem with this whole plan actually comes here. You quickly find that there are many examples where the spectrum of mass dimensions don't correspond to the spectrum of invariance of any Weyl group. Or you can turn this around and say, if I have any set polynomials, homogeneous polynomials of some set of dimensions, they are the invariant polynomials with respect to some discrete group. And it's always a complex reflection group, and then there's some classification of complex reflection groups. And the Weyl groups are a small subset of all the possible complex reflection groups. And so what you find are these discrete symmetries which don't belong to they're not these, they're not in the list of Weyl groups. There are these other things. So what do we do with that? On the one hand, you could say, well, is there some weird symmetry that's not compact Lie algebra symmetry? Well, that seems kind of crazy. It would go against the Coleman-Mandula theorem. Or you could say that somehow some of these complex reflection, these larger or these different complex reflection groups, that maybe they are sort of accidental symmetries, but accidental discrete symmetries, but then there are many cases in which these things don't contain any vital symmetries as sub-symmetries, so that doesn't work either. And one thing that we've noticed is that we only, in all the cases in which you find a spectrum of dimensions which does correspond to a vial symmetry group, those always correspond to cases in which the monodromies of the singularities that it breaks up into are all of AN type. And the cases which are not vial symmetries are monodromies which are not of AN type. They're either of DN or of the of this list of seven scale invariant monodromies. So we make an assumption, and I don't think there's any way around this, which I'll just call simple singularities. Which is to say that only deformations with which give AN singularities for generic masses are allowed, correspond to Coulomb branches of physical theories. In some sense, this is a basic kind of the same assumption that Seiberg and Witten used in their original paper for SU2 Yang Mills. There they said, what's the simplest possibility? The singularity is going to be two A1 singularities. Oh, actually, I guess they would be A0 singularities. That would be the monopole and dyon point. You can give some evidence for this in the sense that AN of the Lagrangian type singularities, the D4, the D in the AN series, the AN singularities are the only ones that have the possibility that they cannot be deformed further, right? For the DN singularities, in the Lagrangian theories, you can always turn on, there always exist relevant operators which split the singularities further. But if the AN singularity is interpreted precisely as a U1 theory with a single charge root N hypermultiplet, then turning on a mass term for that hypermultiplet does not break up the singularity. All it does is move that, keeps the singularity the same and move it around on the Coulomb branch. So that's at least consistent with the Lagrangian point of view. So the other possible singularities are these guys. This would be equivalent to the statement that there doesn't exist, you know, conformal field theories which with one of these singularities which have no relevant deformations. Now, I have no idea how you would prove that, certainly not using low energy field theory techniques. So this would correspond to the assumption that there exist some sort of non-trivial conformal field theories which have no relevant deformations, n equals 2 deformations. You're saying that you land on one of these singularities and that we're just saying that there does not exist an operator which allows it to be deformed further.
That means your assumption is wrong.
This assumption amounts to assuming that, that cannot happen, yeah. Right. So I don't know how to prove that using low energy field theory techniques. But anyway, this is our assumption. And so we're only going to actually look now at Kodaira, at try to classify these things where all these KIs are their conjugates are in the conjugacy classes of some AN singularity, so that they're in the conjugacy class of a T to the minus N or some positive integer.
Excuse me. Are you allowing for cases where you get a while group which is not of one of those groups?
Oh, yeah. We'll find many examples like that. So the relation between these names and the actual conformal field theories is these names were inspired by a pattern of intersections that arose from looking at resolutions of these singularities. And this is the physics here is completely different. It's asking us about complex deformations of the singularities as opposed to resolutions. So the fact that there should be any relationship between the two would be a surprise to start with.
So, but at the same time, it is also true that this E6 and D4, they actually correspond to theories with E6 and D4.
Yeah, it does. So there do exist examples of these four that actually happen to have these flavor symmetries. But then there are many others that don't. So that's, if there's one takeaway.
Right, that would be that. Okay.
So these singularities, right, will then correspond to a hypermultiplet with charge the square root of this integer ni. Actually, when I say charge, there's no reason they all have to be electrically charged. So I really should talk about their vector of magnetic and electric charges, right? And of course, I can always go to an electric-magnetic duality frame in which I rotate them to be electric charges. So I'm talking about the charge in that frame, or equivalently. So this is the dionic charges, the vector of electric magnetic.
But it's not integers, or?
No, I'll get to that in a second. It's important that does not need to be integer. And so what the actual definition is that this I'll call this the electric magnetic duality invariant charge. Its square is the greatest common divisor of the squares of the magnetic charge and the electric charge in any given duality frame. Now the Dirac quantization condition generally says that after we've normalized out by 4 pi's and the value of the coupling constant, that the magnetic and electric charges are integers. But it actually doesn't say that. It says that the product of them is an integer. So in general, a solution to that is that the magnetic and electric charges can be integers times some. So the general solution for the Dirac quantization condition would be that the p's are some integers, let me call them c's, times, I don't know what, times some perhaps irrational number, and the q's are some integers, which I'll call d, times some other irrational number. And that's fine as long as the product of these two guys is itself an integer, which I'll call capital P. Okay? And now, if capital P were 1, right, then that's just saying that these guys are inversely related, and I could just reabsorb them in my definition of my coupling constant, because the coupling constants come in inversely in this normalization and the electric and magnetic charges. But if this integer is not 1, then I can't reabsorb it in that way. Okay? And so what I could do is do that, reabsorb it in such a way that I make these guys equal, that is to say the square root of p. Okay, and that's how these square root of integer charges are allowed to appear. And we'll see examples where they do appear. They actually appeared in the very first papers in Seiberg and Witten, though they didn't introduce them as square roots of charges. They instead redefined what they meant by their coupling by putting in an extra factor of 2.
And for but you're saying that you find a coupling would not help you, right? If P was not 1.
No.
In that case, P was essentially 1, right?
No. P was not. They in their solution for the n equals the SU2 n equals 2 star theory, P was not 1. P was 2. In my language, something that might help for experts is that the geometrical way of talking about this is that this Dirac, Zwanziger, or whatever inner product of charges that it enters into the Dirac quantization condition can be encoded in the geometry as a polarization on the fibers, on the torus fibers, and if this was 1, this would correspond to a principal polarization, but there's no reason the polarization has to be principal. So this is kind of the elementary divisor of the polarization on the fibers. but you can kind of think of it as let's just leave it there. So there is a set of invariant charges now.
But when you're defining the analog of, say, A and AD, right? You can obviously define A and D to make it integer, right?
Yes. That's actually what Seiberg and Witten did in their original paper. So they rescaled A relative to A dual by a factor of 2.
Yeah.
And what I was going to do is not rescale them. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyway, I think this is the more invariant language, and it also generalizes in a simple way to higher ranks. But anyway, so in this way, we really have this, there's no reason that these guys all have to be electrically charged. So in a given, with respect to a given duality basis here and so forth, they'll be an associated set of the electric and magnetic charge vectors of the hypermultiplets that's vanishing at each of these guys. What those are is not actually uniquely specified, not only under general basis duality frame change, but also I chose some arbitrary basis of the cycles around these guys. And if I can move those around, that's essentially some braid transformation on these, and that changes these charges. But something that remains invariant is the kind of unordered set of these electric magnetic duality invariant charges. So I'll take this set as a characterization, maybe not a unique characterization, of this data. I can't prove it, but I believe that this unordered set completely specifies the equivalency class of this data under these braid transformations. So now, and remember that the order of the vanishing of an an singularity or an an minus 1 singularity was n, and n was q squared. So the sum of these guys squared has to be equal to the total order of whatever the discriminant of my original singularity is. So this puts a constraint. And so I can just write down all the possible ways of breaking this up. And I get a long list of possible kind of deformation patterns. That's what we call this. So I'm just trying to make a classification of the possible deformation parameters. But one thing that I do know is if, let's say I find a q here, which is 1, and a q for this guy, which is root 2, this would then violate the Dirac quantization condition. It's fine for this hypermultiplet by itself, but the Dirac quantization condition has to apply to all the states in the theory. So these are some massless states, and these are some massless states, and these guys are not commensurate with respect to these guys, right? And what I really need to do is move the states from here over to here, and they may decay across curves of marginal stability and stuff like that. But that doesn't change this commensurability argument. So what, even though the QIs don't have to be integers, they can be square roots of integers, what does have to be true is that this whole set has to be commensurate. Okay? So it's not just any set that I can write down. The Dirac quantization condition says I should only write down commensurate sets. And so if I do that, you get a fairly short list of possibilities.
Is this characterization has anything to do with your initial assumption of this?
This follows from this initial assumption because I'm characterizing singularities which were all of AN type. They wouldn't have conjugacy classes which look like this if I allowed the other singularities. In fact, here are the conjugate. They're not of these T to the N types. Here are their conjugacy classes. So, well, one obvious thing is I have all of the 10 guys all of charge 1. I'll use this notation where this just tells me the number of charge 1 guys, right? And similarly, I can do it for all of these guys. And like I said, these are the maximal deformations. Yep.
The total monodromy should match up with the original monodromy.
Yes.
So if it is only consisting of T's?
No. The conjugacy class has to be T. So the given K can be G times G inverse. So the product of, even though two of these guys may be in both in the same conjugacy class, their product doesn't have to be also in T. Right. In fact, you know, like that's the original Seiberg-Witten solution. One's a dion, one's a monopole. The conjugacy class is something else. So here are these sort of maximal mass deformations. These ones were actually ones that have been worked out long time ago, right? And these are the Minahan-Mamashansky ones and so forth. But there are lots of other possibilities. And here are some other ones. And I'm kind of running short of time, so I'm only getting through, of course, always less than what I thought. So there's actually many more. For instance, there would be a square root of 2, root 2 charge guys would be a deformation of this one. And there's another handful, you know, 10 or so more that you could write down. So it's just a matter of writing down sets of these numbers, satisfying this condition, and also being commensurate, right? So these satisfy these conditions. The ones that I've kept here, except for this one, can all of these be realized by finding some polynomials f and g? And the answer is no. And in this case, there's a nice trick, which is I can compute the trace of the total monodromy. There's a nice formula for the trace of the total monodromy, which shows that it has certain divisibility properties depending on the values of the q's that appear here. So irrespective of what the g's that appear here are, and I can use these to rule out all these other cases, and leaving me with this list of 13 possibilities. Okay. So I'm almost out of time, so let me just cut to the chase, I guess. Then you have to try to figure out how can I write down polynomials that actually realize these cases. My argument didn't prove that they existed, but So you have to actually construct them in some way. Well, it turns out that these polynomials are easy to write down because they're simply the maximal deformation. You just put in you just parameterize all possible complex deformations. And so these curves are easy to write down, and you immediately read off the Weyl groups. And indeed, the Weyl groups of these guys are E8, E7, E6, D4, A2, A1, and no symmetry here. Okay? Finding the curves is not the end of the story. You have to do that number three step. That's quite difficult. Seiberg and Witten did it in this case, and Minahan and Nemeshansky did it in these three cases. So they all exist as geometries, and this is the well-known list of the seven geometries. And remember, this one is actually this is the Lagrangian theory, the SU2 with four flavors. It actually is actually a whole one-parameter family of geometries. I should have said, these guys, this is a special class that depends continuously on one complex parameter. That's the marginal coupling in that case. So what are these? So then there are these other guys. And so there are techniques which I'm not having time to tell you about, which is that starting from the maximal deformations and knowing this data, you can efficiently construct or show that they don't exist, these polynomials. And we find that in every case, there exists a polynomial. And you can then read off the flavor symmetry. And here they are.
When you say read off, you mean read off the Weyl group?
Read off the Weyl group. The Weyl group determines the flavor symmetry, except that the Weyl group of Bn is equal to the Weyl group of Cn. So these two cases could have been B5 and B3 instead of C5 and C3. So from the curve alone, you can't tell. You also have to, that's not enough, of course, you have to go through the third step and construct the Seiberg-Witten one form. That just takes a lot of work. And we constructed them for all of these cases. I mean, it's long Mathematica sessions. And there's something interesting about, we construct them in the so-called Minahan-Nemeshansky ansatz. And then the poles, of course, will appear in orbits of the Weyl group. But even though the Weyl group of these two guys are the same, irreducible representations of Bn and Cn can be composed of different unions of different orbits of the Weyl group. And what we find here is that the orbits of the Weyl group correspond to irreducible representations of Cn and not Bn. And there's other evidence coming from S-duality arguments that they should have been the SP groups and not the SLM groups.
There was some question about the guy.
This guy.
This guy that you
see. The S-duality arguments weren't able to fix this group. And using Gyodo techniques, really, with the outer automorphism twists, Shackleton, Disler, and Yuji and Tachikawa constructed this guy, but those techniques have a hard time understanding the flavor symmetry, and they predicted from it that the flavor symmetry was going to be rank 4, but it's rank 3. So I think they make the mistake because they based it on an argument on the Higgs branch, and I think they're missing the fact that there is not just what I call that H0 Higgs branch. In this case, there's also one of those mixed Higgs branches. So this is a new one, not having constructed before, not seen from any S-duality arguments or from the Gyodo in the S-class techniques. So it's a challenge. Does there exist such a thing with
the before ones? Are those new?
And these guys are completely equivalent. They look like two different geometries, but when you write down their curves, they give exactly the same predictions. And these are both the n equals 2 star theories, the n equals 4 theories. from the point of view of SU2, they have an SU2 flavor symmetry. This is the form of the curve that Seiberg and Winton wrote down, and this is just kind of what you might call an isogenous form of the curve. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind, that sometimes you can, in this algebraic classification, you can come up with what look like two different theories, but they turn out to be identical. So you get this list of 12 theories, one of which is new. And in the negative 2 minutes remaining, part two of my talk, which I'm obviously not going to get to, would talk about examples where, when I do the mass deformations, the singularity is deformed to something that, you know, might have like some handles in addition to all these cusps and stuff on them. Or there are other cases where it looks like, where it could look like, you know, a bouquet of cones. This is also a scale invariant geometry. And when you turn on the mass, the generic mass deformation, it smooths out, so to speak. Maybe it also has some higher genus features in here and some singularities. And we can construct a couple of examples like this, which intriguingly, two examples which we can construct like this happen to have G2 and F4, the other two exceptional flavor groups.
So these must be deformations of this list.
Yeah, both of these look like isolated deformations of the D4 list.
Isolated meaning that you fix.
They don't have a marginal parameter.
Some value.
Yeah. Well, you see, they don't really. The funny thing is, they don't arise from deforming D4. I'd have to tell you some more details. But what you do is you look at deformations in this way of the E7 and E6 curves. And this one gives me the F4 and F2 and G2. But they wouldn't be in this list because they don't satisfy the Dirac quantization condition. So they're these non-charge commensurate deformations. However, they do satisfy the Dirac quantization condition. If I have them live not on the Coulomb branch, but on a Riemann surface over the Coulomb branch with appropriate cuts. Those cuts are put in basically in a unique way to restore commensurateness of the charges. And by putting in those cuts, one of the cuts all in these two cases runs out to infinity and doubles or triples the opening angle, two-thirds of the opening angle, to give you the D4 singularity. So I said that way too fast, but I'm happy to tell you all the details.
The G2 case in Giotto theory with a torus with one maximal puncture has a G2. Is this related? SU3, sorry, yeah. Maximal of SU3, genus 1 has that.
It's not rank 1.
Yeah, but that's the problem. It's not rank 1, right? So.
So is there any way of understanding the new SCFTs arising in this way as deformation of the original SCFTs with some degenerate mass?
No, they are distinct deformations. One way of seeing this, for instance, is this following group theory fact, which is that C5 is not a subgroup of E8, which seems a little weird, given how big E8 is. But it's nevertheless true. C5 does not fit into E8.
No, wild groups, at the level of wild groups also, they don't fit.
Is that true?
No, I'm asking.
That, I don't know. Yeah, it seems hard to imagine that the C5 wild group doesn't fit into E8 wild group.
Is there any way you could imagine Higgsing could bring one?
Oh, well, there are flows, actually. Oh, no. No.
Yeah,
no. We can construct flows like this and flows like this, but I don't know flows that go between the two.
So
Sorry, for the two cases of E6, one is a, you said is a free maximal puncture of a Kyoto, right? On the Riemann sphere, the E6, the first one.
This one, yeah.
Do you remember the second? What's the description?
Well, you have to use a Z3 outer automorphism twist of the D4 curve. The paper from a year ago of Chakaltana, Disler, and Tachikawa has a section talking about this curve.
And do you know the central charge in all of this?
I know the central charges and dimensions of the Higgs branches for everything, but this one, I only know relations among the central charges. There's one undetermined parameter, which is the dimension. So it's between, it's some integer between 1 and 12, which is the dimension of what I would call that mixed Higgs branch, the quaternionic dimension of that mixed Higgs branch. And given your inequalities, that actually tells us that it actually has to be less than or equal to 8 or something like that.
So you like A and C in terms of essentially?
Yeah. And again, I can show you the actual expressions.
Is such a thing possible that a D4 theory at a particular point in the tau space enhances flavor symmetry?
I would have thought at most you get some extra discrete enhancement. But
the fact, one fact is that triality along with the wild group of D4 is wild group F4.
Right, I understand.
Are the central charges same for F4 on?
I don't know. I'm still working on. So, you know, the method for just from the curves for figuring out the central charge is you do a topological twist and you try to understand the response of the measure for integrating the low energy theory over the Coulomb branch to the background instant curvatures and so forth, whatever those things are, the Euler number and the signature, and so I'm not getting consistent answers at the moment. So I don't know, work in progress. I have to figure out how to generalize that from doing the integral over the disk or the plane to doing it over these Riemann surfaces.
Let's take a look.